and the History of Art Department alone has another lecture this exact same time. So this is the last series of lectures for this semester, sponsored by the American and New England Studies Program in our year-long series on material culture. The first lecture had two scholars from the Rhode Island School of Design working on a collaboration between a studio project and a history project, the Witness Tree Project. And today we are very pleased to have Sarah Carter here, and I'll introduce her in a moment. I just wanted to comment on the rest of the year. On January 29th, the next lecture in the series is by Stephen Prothero, who's a professor of religion at BU, and he is at the moment a fellow at the Smithsonian Institution working on an exhibition on the interaction between religion and objects, pulling objects out of the collections at the Smithsonian and making an exhibition about religion. He'll be talking about his project on January 29th, and in February, Marie Abbé, who is an assistant professor of ethnomusicology in the College of Fine Arts, is going to be talking about accordion culture in California. And so that's going to be the last of our formal lectures in the material culture series this year, and then in the spring, in the third week in April, yes. March 23rd, there's a graduate student conference on material culture, which will be taking place also at Boston University. So we have a whole year's worth of activities having to do with material culture, and we hope you'll come to all of them. So what I'd like to do today is to introduce Sarah Carter, who's going to talk to us about object lessons and material culture. Sarah holds an undergraduate degree and a PhD from Harvard University, where she received her PhD after being for an MA program at the Winterthur Program in Material Culture. So for those of you who have connections with the Winterthur Program, that's a long part of what her background is, the MA in Early American Culture, which she received in 2004. She received her PhD at Harvard in 2010. Sarah is currently a lecturer in the History and Literature Department at Harvard University, and she is leaving Boston on January 15th in order to become the new curator at the Chipstone Foundation in Milwaukee, which is the extraordinary foundation for material culture and decorative arts connected with the Milwaukee Art Museum. So that's going to be really cold and a wonderful, wonderful change of scene for her. She has a number of publications. She's working on a book project about the object lessons material that she'll talk with us today on. And some of her earlier articles include Stuffed in a Parakeet, I don't have my reading glasses, so forgive me. Speculations on Alexander Wilson's Faithful Companion Specimen in Commonplace in 2012. Another essay called On an Object Lesson or Don't Eat the Evidence in the Journal of the History of Childhood and Youth in 2010.
Yeah. Do you want glasses?
No, I'll just go like that. Thank you. Another essay called Picturing Rooms, Interior Photography, 1870 to 1900 in History of Photography in 2010. Another essay called Reinstalling Mrs. Ward's Corner Cupboard, Narrative and Display in a Colonial Revival House Museum in Museum History Journal. So you can see she has a very wide range of kinds of topics that she works on. She also has very innovative teaching ideas in the courses that she's teaching, and I hope she'll talk about that a little bit, creating interactive websites as well as scholarly projects, which seems to be a theme because we talked about that a little bit in the first guest lectures we had from RISD. So I welcome Sarah, and she's going to talk to us about object lessons and material culture. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kim, and thank you so much for inviting me here. I was really delighted to have the chance to come and share my work with all of you tonight. And I know this is a busy time of year, so I'm grateful that you took the time out of all of your grading, teaching, paper writing that I know all of you, or lecturing, as you're about to do, as I know all of you are doing. So thank you. Today I'm going to be presenting just a small part of my larger book project, which I'm currently working on, which is tentatively titled How 19th Century Americans Learned to Think: Object Lessons in American Material Culture, which looks at the history of reasoning from and through objects, images, and even the bodies of people in the 19th century United States. If I speak at this level, can everyone hear me?
A little louder.
A little louder? Okay. I've discovered through several years of research that this is something that Americans were consciously taught to do through a common classroom practice called object lessons. Now, I'm sure that you've all heard the phrase object lesson. If you were to go home and type it into the New York Times right now, you'd see many different uses of that phrase coming up in the last few weeks. You know, Obama's re-election has been referred to as an object lesson. Various new changes on Facebook, they're object lessons. It's a common metaphor that we hear frequently. Those of us who study material culture know it because it's commonly used as subtitles or titles in material culture books, because it's such a useful metaphor for those of us who study objects. But long before it was a metaphor, it was actually a series of very concrete classroom practices that were designed to teach children from age 4, in some cases all the way up through university age students, how to move from the study of a material thing, from the study of an object, to be able to draw a conclusion about that thing. In the process, moving from an object to an abstract idea about that object. The major historical actors in my project are teachers and students, the people who actually engaged with these object lessons every day, and their creative use and interpretation of the pedagogy that I'll be telling you about transformed object lessons from a simple schoolroom exercise into a major cultural phenomenon. In my larger book manuscript, I argue that this phenomenon shaped the ways Americans understood and talked about, yes, the material things at the center of these lessons, but also about the ways people understood moral reasoning in the family, differences between reality and representation, capitalism, and conceptions of citizenship, and how all of these ideas could be developed through one's interaction with material things. I'm going to spend some time today talking about one particular school, one particular place where object lessons were used quite extensively, and that's at the Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute in Virginia. We're going to spend some time on Hampton because there we're going to be able to examine the complex and sometimes troubling ways the object lesson idea structured the specific school's entire curriculum. But much more importantly, this case study will allow us to consider how object lessons can cast one's interactions with the material world as a form of reasoning, and transformed the African American and Native American students who studied at Hampton, transformed themselves into object lessons, into the objects of this study. And in particular, we're going to spend some time with this photograph. I'll come back to it a bit later. It's a well-known photograph. I'm sure you've all seen it, or many of you have seen it, a photograph of Lewis Firetail by Frances Benjamin Johnson, you know, the so-called most famous woman photographer in the world when it was taken. And it can help us see, by looking closely at it, see how people like Firetail himself were understood as a very particular kind of object lesson. And we're going to return to this photograph later on. A key goal of my overall project is to think of the historical object lesson as an analytical tool that others could potentially use. And this is something that I've been experimenting with in my own research on domestic interiors, taxidermy, and even more recently through my work on Harriet Beecher Stowe's visual art. To meet this goal, to offer object lessons as a tool, my talk today is divided into two parts. In the first part of my talk, I want to explain the many ways objects became lessons in the 19th century classroom. The ways in which the study of even a simple cookie, like this one, which I had the pleasure of finding in the archives at Princeton, could become an intellectual exercise. I will offer a general history of object lessons, and more specifically, object lessons at Hampton. Then I'll consider the ways people could become objects in the context of object lessons, and what was at stake in that transformation. And finally, we'll return to think briefly about how we might use object lessons in a tool in our own practice as material culture teachers. So first, how did objects become lessons? And I know we're all image people, but I have a few timelines in here because these are unfamiliar names, and sometimes it's helpful to be grounded, you know, in a historical moment. So my consideration of object lessons begins in the schoolroom of Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi, who was a Romantic pedagogue, a Swiss Romantic pedagogue, around the turn of the 19th century, and those are the years when he's active as a teacher. So 1798 into the 1820s, he developed classroom practices premised on what he viewed as a mother's approach to teaching. And Pestalozzi is always represented this way, as this loving man who's gazing into the eyes of his charges, and all of these images, people are always looking, staring at things. You know, he's trying, they're showing him looking, showing observation. He developed classroom premises premised on what he viewed as a mother's approach to teaching. Mothers, he observed and described, tried to draw information out of children, not cram ideas into them. Physical engagement with the world was a way to achieve this through sense training exercises, or what he called Anschauungsunterricht, so like sense perception Anschauungsunterricht exercises. He believed that this is how you could teach children how to think, by training their senses. From Pestalozzi's schoolrooms, his student teachers, particularly a man by the name of Charles Mayo, an Englishman who was studying in Pestalozzi's schools in order to become a teacher, took these ideas and translated them and transplanted them to England. It's this man, Charles Mayo's idea of object lessons that will become the foundation of object lessons in the United States. This formal object lesson method that Charles Mayo developed was a British interpretation of Pestalozzi's romantic pedagogy, developed very much through the work of his sister, Elizabeth. And in one of those great, you know, frustrating research experiences, it's very little about Elizabeth. It's almost impossible to pry her out from under her brother's shadow. But from all that I can find, it seems that they are very much equal partners in this endeavor. She was really a pioneer, along with her brother, in teacher education. And together, they worked at the highly regimented home and colonial schools in London. And it was through the home and colonial schools in London that this pedagogy, object lessons, is spread throughout the British Empire. And it might seem like a stretch to say this, but they truly believed that object study could lead to both moral and critical reasoning. As Elizabeth Mayo explains in one of her publications, quote, "Minds accustomed to accurate investigation will not rest content with less than satisfactory evidence, either in morals or science." The idea being, if you learned how to look, if you learned how to observe, you would develop reasoning skills. You would be more of a moral person. You would be a better person through learning how to see the world around you. At this point in the 1830s, this is roughly what an object lesson looked like. You would start with observation, describing the thing you're looking at. Then you would move on to study objects for their qualities, their constitutive qualities that made that object what it was. Then you would study objects for qualities that could not be discerned merely through the senses. Then you would classify those objects, and then you would move on to write about those objects. So observation, qualities, what are qualities I can't get through observation, how do I classify this, and then you would write about it. So for example, let's say we take something like a hunk of ginger, a common object lesson. First, a student would be led in the classroom to study and describe that ginger, describe its texture, describe what you're looking at, what color is it, you know, what does it smell like? Try to maybe taste it and taste that spicy taste. All of these different experiences you're supposed to have through engaging with the actual thing. Then you'd figure out, well, what are those qualities? It's, you know, it's opaque. And these words might sound funny, but these are the terms an object teacher was hoping to elicit from a student. Is it opaque? Is it aromatic? Is it rough? Is it pulverable? Is it stimulating if you eat a piece of it? These are qualities that make that a hunk of ginger. Then moving on from there, you know, what are things about this that you can't get just from looking? It's foreign, right? It's imported. Maybe it has some sort of medicinal qualities. Next, you were to move on to try to categorize it, you know, part of a group of spices. And then finally, you would write about it. Now, through this rhetoric, through this lesson, a child would be led to associate an abstract concept with an object, right? And it might seem very innocuous if you're learning that a hunk of ginger is foreign, but that mode of reasoning becomes applied in other ways and to other things as well. So we'll start with this basic idea. Object lessons helped teachers associate the material world with abstract concepts. for those of you who might be material culture scholars familiar with the work of, say, Jules Proun, this methodology might be very familiar to you as well. In his work, say, for example, Mind and Matter, his 1982 essay, where he puts forth a methodology for how you can look at objects. This is almost a direct analog to a Prounian method 150 years later. It's very similar. And I asked Professor Proun about this, and he's, you know, jokingly said, you know, I'm not that old. Like, I never learned their object lessons. But there might be something to it. There are some interesting parallels between these two methods. Now, by the mid-19th century, object lessons through the home and colonial schools had become a truly global phenomenon. And I've traced this imperial pedagogy to New Zealand, to Australia. I found object lesson texts translated into Bengali. I mean, this methodology is all over the world by the mid-19th century through the home and colonial schools. And most importantly to us, it's in Toronto, Canada. It comes to the U.S. through Toronto on a ferry across Lake Ontario through a man named E.A. Sheldon. E.A. Sheldon was an educator in Oswego, New York, upstate New York, and he became very frustrated with the fact that students in Oswego were learning mainly through rote memorization. And he learned about this object lesson method in Toronto and decided to try to bring it to the United States. He worked with a woman named Miss Jones from the Home and Colonial Schools, and together they basically pirated, took all of the Mayo's work, republished it in the United States, and it quickly spread throughout the United States. They represented the power of the object lesson graphically as a tree. And I'm not sure if you can read what's on the trunk, but I'll tell you what it says. Basically, at the base, we have education of the senses. The idea that they tried to spread throughout the U.S. was that starting with education of the senses at the roots, you'd move up through perception and then end up with all of this higher order thinking. Understanding of order, difference, likeness, cause and effect, perception of judgment. These were all of the reasoning skills that they believed that you could get through the study of object lessons. The main idea of all of these lessons was that through sense training, children would learn to think and not merely parrot the ideas given to them by teachers. This is the anecdote to memorization. The idea is that through this, you would learn to come to your own conclusions. Variations on these had been in use in the U.S. for years before this, but this is when object lessons starts to become really popular. And many object teachers argued at the time that the 1860s was the perfect moment for object lessons to become popular. Because if children had learned to think for themselves, perhaps the Civil War could have even been prevented, right? Is one idea. I think that might just be, you know, you're trying to write a great grant application. You're saying, if only we had taught our object lessons, we would not be at war. But I think some people truly believe this, that if you learn to think for yourself, we would be in a much better political state. Now, it's hard to quantify exactly the spread of this pedagogy because there's been almost nothing on this practice. But through 2 years of archival research, ranging from the New York Historical to the Huntington Library, I've been able to trace this across the United States in the 1860s. Progressive educators in schools across the continent are employing this. This is best practices. It was taught alongside reading, mathematics, moral lessons, geography, and many other subjects, all of which could be presented objectively through objects, through images, as well as through texts. And training in giving object lessons is soon offered in most normal schools. New York City began offering special instruction in object teaching in 1862. The California State Teachers Exam for the following year, 63, asks as one of the questions you must pass in order to teach there, have you any practice in giving object lessons? The Chicago Tribune, around the same time, published this explanation of object lessons for those who were just learning about the practice. The new feature in teaching is being now rapidly introduced everywhere. It's object lessons. The idea simply is to present an object for a lesson instead of a picture or a description of some object. This real object being theoretically a nucleus around which is to be grouped the facts and relations pertaining to that object. So you have this notion that you have something that you bring into the classroom and then you weave everything else around it. All of these ideas are going to be associated with that thing at the center of your lesson. In addition to formal five-step lessons, like the one I described, object lessons also came to refer to other kinds of classroom practices that are similar, like this one. In this case, we have a teacher holding up a form, a very popular object teaching aid to her students, likely teaching them a lesson on the concept of sphere. Like, this is what a sphere is. And looking closely at this image, we can wonder even if she's making a connection between the sphere in her hand and the globe on the floor, something formally suggested by looking at this illustration. So, lessons like these. We also have evidence of teachers using things like pen knives and other objects. This is a pupil teacher's notebook where she's learning how to give object lessons. And here showing how you could use something as simple as a pen knife to try to teach students about angles. And in some cases, the regimented approach of object lessons was even applied to the study of pictures. I don't have time to go into it today, but taking an image like this, an object teacher would try to help students understand how different parts of this picture could be viewed as all leading up to an argument about its moral meaning. For example, that teacup on the table as telling a story about how this man is coming home to tea and not going out drinking. While that might sound like something I'm projecting onto it, these are lesson plans that were published to go along with these images as to how these should be used in the classroom. Students were also to explicitly study images like these. And some of you may have seen these lithographs. Lithographs like these to learn how labor could be crystallized into objects, echoing in a way themes from Marx. Like, these well-known 19th century lithographs are actually part of a series that was actually published along with lesson plans that teachers could give to their students. So in this case, we have a lithograph that's actually teaching you about lithography. And irony, that's not lost on those teachers. That's part of the lesson. Let's study this lithograph in your hands and learn how lithography is done. You know, we're even to help them recast the labor around them in their own homes. A picture lesson here on how a pie is made. And in the lesson plan that goes along with it, the clock on the wall, the sink, these are all key tools being used by this woman making this pie. And object lesson methods were also adapted for kindergarten, things that we're familiar with today. Now, lessons were also employed to study hybrid objects, like this picture, which I mentioned, where you have actual things glued onto a large piece of cardboard or cardstock. In this case, the lesson is supposed to lead you to understand the strange alchemy through which something like a stalk of wheat could become a cookie, or a piece of or macaroni, or braided plate, to understand the actual transformation through which the objects around you might go through to come into the state they are when you experience them. And I write about all of this at length and would be delighted to answer questions about it later on. All of these lessons relied on the rhetorical power of the object lesson to do two things. To impart the notion that through studying something closely, one could find information about the world. Whether about that object's origin, its production, its value, its meaning, information about it actually embedded in that thing through your study of it. And secondly, that engaging with these things would teach the students doing it how to think, would teach them how to better understand the world around them. So now that I hope you have an introduction to object lessons beyond the metaphor that you often read in the Times or here on NPR, I want us to move to think about a very specific way in which object lessons were employed. Oh, and just briefly, it's all over advertising too at the same time, which is pretty fascinating. Okay. The Hampton Institute in Virginia opened its doors in 1868. It was founded in the wake of the Civil War by Samuel Chapman Armstrong. And Hampton's stated purpose was to prepare the youth of the South without distinction of color for the work of organizing and instructing schools in the southern states. The goal was initially to train African-American teachers who would go on to lead schools throughout the South. But the students were not simply trained to teach. They were also trained to work, as I'm sure many of you know from reading and learning about Hampton or other similar schools. And manual labor was a big part of the school's curriculum. And this is sometimes referred to as the Hampton idea or education for life. But this education for life, what I've discovered through my research, was in fact another application of object lesson pedagogy, was an extension and a development of that kind of object-based learning that I've talked about earlier. And very much a part of the material and visual rhetoric that structured life at the school. Now, Hampton is often associated with the education of African Americans, but Native Americans were also educated there. In 1878, a group of Native Americans who had been held as prisoners of war at Fort Marion were brought to Hampton under duress in an attempt to educate and quote-unquote civilize them. And from that point, Hampton went on to educate Native American students into the 1920s. When this photograph was taken in 1899, Hampton students were both African American and Native American men and women. This was taken on November 30th, so tomorrow, but in 1899. And we're looking at a student by the name of Lewis Firetail. Firetail is a Crow Creek Sioux, is standing there on a small platform in front of 14 of his classmates and their teacher. And in this setting, he comprises a very specific kind of classroom study. Like the taxidermy eagle perched on the table behind him and the geological specimens that are in that corner to the back left of the image, this young Sioux man, who had recently spent a summer in Massachusetts working on a farm, studying carpentry, was also, in this case, an object lesson. Francis Benjamin Johnson's photograph of Firetail is one frame in a series of beautiful, haunting, compelling, and extremely well-known publicity photographs that were taken at Hampton. The photographs from which this image is taken depict the students in class, at work, at rest, the campus, homes of graduates, and these well-known images have a very long afterlife and an even longer bibliography that I can't address right now. I want us to look at this photograph and a few of Johnson's other photographs to help us understand the key ways that object lessons undergird Hampton's curriculum, teaching students how to find ideas and things, and crucially, teaching them to think and feel in certain ways through labor and transforming them into lessons. At the same time, visitors to the school, federal officials, members of the community were directly instructed to view the students at this school themselves as living object lessons, repeatedly instructed to do that. This is not me interpreting it. This is what they're told. These are students learning by object lessons and actually living as object lessons. Object lessons of what Native American and African American students could become after education at Hampton. This became a way to argue for this rights to citizenship for these graduates, not based on natural rights, as we would argue, but based on their appearances, on their specific ability to serve as an object lesson of a civilized or successful man or woman. Whether managing a home and farm in a rural southern town or carefully keeping house on a western reservation. To understand the power of this rhetoric at Hampton, we need to consider how object lessons were used here in the classroom from 1868 through 1899. To consider how these methods supposedly taught students to reason through study and labor, and to figure out how someone like Lewis Firetail could himself be a lesson. In 1868, the school's initial mission as a normal school all but mandated the inclusion of object lessons. Best practices for primary school education in progressive common schools in the 60s and 70s included these lessons. Racist ideas about African Americans' supposed ability to sense more accurately than whites could make them appear to be particularly susceptible to the study of material things. And further racist stereotypes about Native Americans also reinforced the use of object lessons for their education. So years after, object lessons are less likely to be used in classrooms for predominantly white students, they're still being used in classrooms for African American and Native American students. Helen Ludlow, who was an instructor at Hampton, came from Oswego, New York, which was the home of object lessons. And she described Native fitness for schoolroom work by contrasting Native students' supposed ability to observe with their inability to, quote, get hold of new ideas. Such a combination of traits would have rendered object lessons the ideal pedagogy for these kinds of students, leveraging their presumed ability to observe to improve their intellectual development. Hampton employed object teaching in a number of ways in this period, in its museum, in the classroom, at the practice school that it ran so that the students in that school could learn how to teach the local students, in order and through the physical labor of most of the students. First, in order to conduct these lessons, Armstrong, the founder, worked quickly to develop teaching collections that could be employed to instruct students about other cultures, geography, history, and general studies, like this class in biblical history, where they're studying archaeological biblical specimens, or this physics class, where they're all examining models. Hampton student teachers were also trained in pedagogical methods in the practice school, as I mentioned, the Butler School at Hampton, which served children aged 6 through 13. The children of the local African American community who would go to school there and then be taught by people learning how to be teachers, like a lab school. Object lessons were a big part of this. But this mode of teaching was not what the parents of these students were expecting. For example, in upstate New York, or in New York City, or in San Francisco, an object lesson on cotton might look like this. It's about both the natural history of that substance, where you see the seed pods and the unprocessed cotton, as well as the consumer goods one could purchase that would help you understand what that cotton could be turned into. Putting those students in a relationship of both the consumer and potentially a producer, they could understand how it's made. You could understand the whole commodity history of this product or this substance. But at Hampton, lessons on cotton looked very different. For example, here is a pupil teacher with actually giving students pieces of raw cotton that they can twist between their fingers to sort of feel and experience that substance. At Hampton, a lesson on cotton in this way evokes a history of manual labor, where perhaps raw cotton and not commodities is what's structuring these lessons. And this is just one example. There are many images of object lessons being done in Southern schools where you're using these raw commodities, unprocessed things. In part, that's very practical. This is much less expensive than ordering a teaching aid. But other lessons are also being imparted at the same time. In 1879, in the Southern Workman, the school paper, it reported on this pedagogy. The object lessons given to the little children of the Butler School this winter have proved quite trying to the faith and patience of some of their parents, who thought that because the little ones did not bring home books to study, they could not be learning anything. So parents are not happy that their children are going to school and learning to play with cotton and not learning to read, right? Which shouldn't be too surprising to any of us. Directing the focus away from literacy was troubling for these parents, who viewed it as the central goal of primary education and a tool that they had been denied under slavery, or that their parents had been denied under slavery. And there were other ways that object lessons produced somewhat troubling outcomes at Hampton. Starting around 1880-81, the Butler School employed a form of pedagogy called the kitchen garden. Not sure, has anyone heard of kitchen gardens? Mm-hmm. The kitchen garden was consciously a play on the word kindergarten, not a garden intended to grow nice vegetables for your dinner. It employed the exact same methods as kindergarten teachers. However, they were modified slightly. So using those same sensory trainings that is supposed to teach a child about the world through their senses, in a kitchen garden, those same methods, those object lessons, dance, that song, the music, the tactile experience was all geared towards teaching children what it felt like to be servants. So, for example, here is, this is from a few years later in New York, but these little girls are learning how to make a bed using kitchen garden methods. The classroom is designed like a kindergarten classroom. Only all of their kindergarten materials are for domestic service. One of Johnson's photographs, taken again in 1899 when she took these images of Hampton, captured a class. This is a regular part of the school curriculum. We have small children learning to iron and wash as if it were a game. And their posture and tiny irons are no different from materials that I've seen published in plenty of kitchen garden manuals. That doesn't mean these children would grow up to be servants. They may well grow up to become teachers and go on to learn at Hampton. But the course intended to teach children how it felt to perform this role. This is part of that sense-based learning that's at the core of object teaching and object lessons, that you would know through your senses what it felt like to perform this kind of act. Learning by laboring was central to the Hampton idea for older students there as well. The work component of the Hampton curriculum conflated physical and mental work. And you know, we know from thinking through object lesson pedagogy that the practice links sensing and thinking. And Hampton linked laboring and learning, you know, linking the head, heart, and hand. When it was founded, Hampton students could expect to conduct farm or mechanical labor for up to 5 hours a day, in addition to pursuing their academic subjects. And as historian James Anderson and others have detailed, formal industrial training did not begin at Hampton till a bit later in the school's history, but hard manual work was there from day one in order to prepare students for the life of labor that Armstrong, their founder, expected that they would experience. And Armstrong frequently described the moral goal of this work as developing industrious habits, which were often linked to mental stimulation. So again, just as learning through object lessons, learning through your senses would teach you how to think, laboring, the idea was, would teach you how to be industrious. Now, while it may be hard to understand now, representations of labor in this model could also be viewed in some ways as representation of thinking and problem solving through object lesson rhetoric. Representations of labor from dressmaking, shown here, to blacksmithing, shown here, resonated with object lessons in trades and occupations, like this example, this lithograph, which I showed earlier, in which each step in a process is separated out in order to be studied and appreciated as evidence of understanding what happens next, understanding a step-by-step process through which something is created, evidence of thinking and ability. Johnson's beautifully composed photographs, I think this one, students at work on a house built largely by them, shows this clearly. It depicts carpenters at work on a staircase, emphasizing the students' active engagement with all parts of the process, a job that required understanding of materials and a self-awareness that permitted six people to work in tight quarters, even if just for that one perfectly staged shot. Images of Hampton students engaged in manual labor, much of it completely outmoded by the time Johnson's recording it, suggests a way of representing reasoning that's not obvious to modern viewers. I'm not arguing that manual labor was an appropriate interpretation or application of this pedagogy at Hampton, merely that through object lessons, intellectual reasoning could be linked to labor and one's engagement with the physical world. This is an argument that Hampton teachers could make based on object lesson pedagogy. In addition to learning through a variety of object lessons, Hampton students were, as I mentioned, transformed into living object lessons during their time at the school. Armstrong said it quite clearly in a report to the American Missionary Society in 1882. At Hampton, there are 90, and at Carlisle, there are nearly 300 Indians, boys and girls, who are learning civilization as an object lesson and are themselves an object lesson. A New York Times article from 1900 put an even finer point on it, and excuse this long quote. It is a normal school in the sense that it is intended to teach teachers, But the teachers, it turns out, are not necessarily engaged in schools. The instruction they offer goes far beyond the usual scope of teachers' work. And the instruction they impart, after they go out of it, is of a nature, influence, and variety such as do not exist in the schooling with which most of us are familiar. Instruction in honorable and productive labor. The article continues. Wherever they are living, they are, as a rule, giving object lessons, in honest industry and thrift, and in the self-respect that goes with these. The students are supposed to be teachers, but they were to offer instruction both actively in the classroom and then passively as object lessons. Many scholars have noted that Hampton graduates were supposed to be missionaries of a Hampton idea, of racially dictated hard work and physical labor. But scholars have missed the pedagogical and epistemological implications of this aspect of their curriculum. To be an object lesson wasn't to be an exemplar, as we might understand it. As an object lesson, one physically embodied an idea that was developed through that individual's work and action. Booker T. Washington, perhaps Hampton's most famous graduate and president of the Tuskegee Institute, modeled on Hampton, often employed the object lesson idea in his own speaking and writing. He was a trained teacher and certainly understood the use of an object lesson in the classroom. He frequently described African-American graduates of Hampton as object lessons. He relied heavily on this metaphor to argue for the efficacy of normal schools, institutions that could bring the entire South into the schoolroom. And he and Armstrong frequently applied this metaphor not only to individuals, but also to their homes. Images like this, quite common, another great Johnson image, to their homes, to their businesses, to their farms. You know, Washington's wife is described as one kind of object lesson. A model farm becomes another kind of lesson. The object lesson came into an increasingly frequent use by the end of the century, but in applying it to the bodies and efforts of teachers, it conveyed a specific meaning. In some ways, it became a material way to argue for respect, equality, and citizenship, or recognition of the rights of citizenship. Instead of claiming these rights based on civil rights or inherent equality, the bodies and actions of these African American or Native American graduates were supposed to provide material evidence. Object lessons were intended to teach students to observe, leading from the close study of material things to the development of abstract concepts. The material thing was necessary because it captured or crystallized the abstract idea to be developed. To call a Hampton graduate an object lesson was not merely to apply a metaphor, but to argue that he or she was the embodiment of the concept of industry or morality. Like acquiring the concept of foreign through the study of ginger, or fusible through the study of sugar, understanding the Hampton graduate as an object lesson was a way of thinking, as well as a way of being. One way Hampton measured and shared the success of its pedagogical method was through its famous before and after photographs of students. And I'm showing you an example here from a textbook actually created by E.A. Sheldon's daughter, who included images like this in her textbook to show how object lesson methods could be used to study history. And E.A. Sheldon, as you may recall from earlier in the presentation, was the fellow who brought object lessons from Toronto to New York. So, you know, his daughter pulled out these images as examples of object lessons that you could use if you're teaching U.S. history. Here we have a Native student arriving in Hampton, and then the person into whom he's transformed through the efforts of that school. The photograph of Lewis Firetail, shown here, in some ways complicates this kind of image. What kind of a lesson can we draw from Lewis? In this photograph, every student is gazing intently at Firetail. The photograph documents an object lesson in progress. And this photograph, which is at the Library of Congress, was captioned at some point as a scene from an American history class and may depict an exercise similar to the pageants and tableaus that took place at Hampton around this time to commemorate historical events. And perhaps that's the kind of lesson Firetail is offering. Perhaps it's that simple.